All right, then. So we're going to talk about right intention. I think intention is probably one of the most profound. I mean, Buddha did a lot of teaching that had a profundity to it. But right intention is a very profound teaching that it takes practicing with it to actually begin to recognize just what it does for us. I mean, in this room, online, as we all sit here, every one of us has this kind of way that we move through the world as if we are responsible for it. Like somehow or another, if the country's messed up, I gotta fix it. If the Seattle streets are messed up, I gotta fix it. And there is this pressure that both comes from society and comes from our own inner expectations to always feel responsible for everything our mind perceives as wrong. We are responsible for fixing it. And that pressure is not you. It is this, underlying tendency toward greed, hatred, and delusion. So the greed part of it is always wanting everything to be right, lovely, good. Everything is the way it's supposed to be. So as soon as something goes wrong, we are trapped in this kind of never-ending, battle. The aversion or the hatred part of it is once something is going wrong and we're in that battle, we just have this natural tendency to push against it and make it right. Everybody's trying to make it right. And what sometimes you can begin to see is sometimes I feel like our pushing, making it right is feeling good. We're like working, we're winning. It feels good. And then all of a sudden, I get the sense that we're losing. We're losing. It's somebody else is pushing against us, and they're making it right, and they seem all happy, but I'm not happy. And there's this push and pull that we live with all the time. Buddha felt that. I know he did. That's why he left. That's why he had such a difficult life when he left. In fact, there's a sutta that I want to read. This isn't the one I was gonna read, but it's the one I want to read because this is to help you understand that the Buddha understand that the Buddha understood. All right, here it is. So this is Andrew Olinsky's translation of a sutta called Kamada, Kamada's Lament is what it's called. Kamada is a spirit being, you know, like a deva. So they live in great realms of everything's going great. There's no difficulty. And so Kamada says to the Buddha, "So hard it is to do, sir. It's so very hard to do." And the Buddha says, "But still, they do what's hard to do. Those who steady themselves with virtue, the ones pursuing a retreat or practice life, contentment arise and with it joy." So hard it is to get, sir. This contentment of what you speak. The Buddha says, but still, they get what's hard to get, who delight in a tranquil mind. The mind of those, both day and night, delights in its development. So hard it is to tame, sir, this mind of which you speak. But still, they tame what's hard to tame, who delight in senses at peace, cutting through mortality's net, the nobles, Kamada, proceed. So hard it is to go, sir, on this path that gets so rough. But still, nobles, Kamada, proceed on paths both rough and hard to take. Those who are less than noble fall upon their heads when the path gets rough. But for the nobles, the path is smooth. For nobles, smooth out what is rough. So to me, when I hear this sutta, I read it to myself all the time, because it isn't that somehow or another we're going to learn some easy way to get through a difficult life. That's not really what we're learning here. And we're not learning how to keep the life from being difficult. We're not coming to some understanding, so now all the difficulty's gone. That isn't what we're doing either. We are learning basically how to move through a difficult life that remains difficult until the end. And we, in our efforts, learn how to move through. So there's another sutta, the sutta that I was going to tell you, that I wanted to start with, is another deva. And if you know me and my practice, I love devas because, you know, they got it made in the shade. They don't have any problems. They have everything going good for them. So why is Kamada whining? Why is he doing that? Why is this next sutta, the woman that comes to the Buddha late at night, she's whining? They're always whining about the difficulties when they have such beautiful lives. Because even in our most, even when everything is going right, even when things are smooth and easy, we will whine and complain about that. So she goes to the Buddha and she asked him, how did he, what she says is cross the floods. And cross the floods is like, how did he get through this difficulty, this mess of a life? How did he do that? And she kind of, they say, is kind of arrogant. Because she assumes that she could just go to the Buddha, ask him how he did it, get the answer, and go do that. So how'd you do it? Very simple, you know, direct. And so the Buddha gave her a curt kind of answer. He said, I crossed the floods by not pushing forward and not standing still. So if you were like me and you heard that, you would be like, it's what she was. And then she said, but how? How did you cross the floods without pushing forward and not standing still? How did you do that? And you know, that's a little bit more intimate. That's a little bit more connected to your pain when you recognize how difficult this world is. You're like, no playing, really. How did you do that? And he told her that he crossed the floods by not pushing forward, because when he pushed forward, he got entangled. And not standing still, because if he just stood still, he would sink. And somehow, he said, I crossed the floods by not pushing forward and not standing still. And after he said it the second time, she understood and realized what he was saying. And to me, what the Buddha was telling her is right effort. There is a way that this practice is asking us to move forward in life, to move through this difficulty without pushing forward and without just standing still. There's something in the nature of right intention that helps us do that. So I don't know. I think Tim taught last week. Did Tim teach last week? I don't know if he told you what right, the word right in the Eightfold Path, what it stands for, but it always bears repeating that right, this word right, is connected to like a musical attunement. So it is harmonious. It is, you know, you can feel music that is in harmony. Even when Beethoven would get those dissonant places, you could almost feel the importance of that dissonance and then the resolve. You could feel it. It's almost what makes his music so beautiful. But in music, you can feel when it is in alignment, in it is harmonious, it is right, it feels right. It doesn't even matter what the music is. You could hate jazz, and jazz could sound like completely off-putting to you. But if you love jazz, you know when jazz is harmonious. If you love rock, and I can remember years ago when my son used to listen to rap. I didn't even think that was music. So if you could listen to rock and other people could think that's not even music, you can listen to hard rock, head-banging rock, and I'm like, that is not music. But if you listen to it and you love it, it becomes music. And somehow you begin to understand the attunement of what's actually being played. So when Thaddeus was younger, I think they still do this, but they used to have these parental advisories on their music for gangster rap because it was too harsh. And so Thaddeus, when we would go to the music store and I would go buy him his little CDs, he had to either get my permission, I had to buy it myself, or he had to get the ones that had the beep, 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 all beep out, all the little swear words and all of that. And so Thaddeus hated that music. He would get so mad. He must have been about maybe probably 14, 15 when we first started doing this. So we made this deal that he could get the music that was parental advisory, but I would have to listen to it with him. And he had to explain, why did they say bitch? And how come they have to keep saying MF, MF, MF? And what is all of this? He had to explain the music to me. So the first album that we did this was Eminem's, like, Coming Out of the Box CD. Oh, my God. And we sat there, and he sat there trying to help me understand why Eminem was swearing so much, why his music was violent to me, but he could hear through that violence that somehow or another, Eminem was talking to a level of rage that his generation was feeling and no outlet of where to put it. And he could help me understand. And I just remember that when Thaddeus bought Eminem's second album, I like some of that. I could begin to hear it, even though it was still way over the top violent to me, but I could begin to understand the misery teenagers were going through in the 90s and those early 2000s when people were not really paying attention to just how violent gang violence was and how violent the world was around them. And they didn't have any kind of a sense of agency about how they're going to get through this. And many, many, many kids and many teenagers were dying, and it was just a very difficult time. Not that it's not now, but this is the music Thaddeus was helping me understand the world through. And we spent many hours listening to his music together, talking about it. And then one day, when I was finally getting to a place where I could really respect rap, and I'm like, I understand, and I could do this. We go to the store to go buy some new music. And Thaddeus gets the parental advisory. He gets the ones without the parental advisory, with all the beeps in it. And I said, oh, Thaddeus, you got the wrong ones. He goes, no, I just want to listen to my music by myself. I can fill in the rest. I was so disappointed. I loved our music time. But the thing that I want to help you see is that Thaddeus did not convince me that the music was okay. He did not convince me. We felt it together, and he showed me, and I began to understand this music from his vantage point because we listened to it together. We felt our way through it. If he had to try to convince me, it wouldn't have worked, because I just had this automatic belief that it's garbage, doesn't make any sense, just a lot of violence, and it's just the reason why the world is so violent right now is because of gangster rap. And yet, when we talked about it, and I felt it, and I heard the music, there was this attuning towards understanding what these artists were trying to say. And it wasn't just Eminem's. It was several different musicians. But I could begin to attune to what they were trying to say and who they were speaking to. And they were not speaking to me. And that's what became clear. So in a way, what the Buddha is trying to point to in right intention is, how are we going to feel our way through a world that's besieged with so much greed, hatred, and delusion, so much grabbing after what we want, this sense of aversive pushing what we don't want, and this kind of ignoring everything except for me. And so how do you move through that kind of a world in such a way that you become awake, become enlightened, become awake. This word enlightenment, we treat it so almost like we're going to go to heaven one day. But it's not like that. It is much more attainable if we're willing to feel our way through these difficulties and begin to understand in this much more gentler, softer, relaxed way of being with the world, being with life, being with experiences. And so this right intention is connected to right view, and it's in the wisdom aspect of this training. And in this wisdom aspect of the training, we have this wise view or right view, harmoniously beginning to watch how you're perceiving the moment or the world. And then this right intention is how you're moving through. So the way that the Buddha sort of categorized this intention is through right, he called it right thought, which is pretty, it's pretty significant that this is right thought. Because in this practice, at least here in the West, we treat thinking like it's a evil, being, like this evil doing that we need to stop. It's the bad side of practice, is all this thinking. And if I could just stop thinking, I would be okay. I would be much better. I would be peaceful and still. But that would be like saying, if I could stop hearing bird songs, or I could stop hearing shifting sounds in the hall, or if I could just stop hearing any sounds, I'd be more peaceful. But I have found, I don't know about you, but that soft shifting sounds and the birds and the traffic and all those little sounds that happen when we're meditating actually is very supportive to my feeling still and relaxed. I wouldn't want that to go away at all. It's the same with sensations. I wouldn't want my tingling and pressure and shifting sensations to go away. I don't even like it when I can't feel the breath because I just get all frazzled. So there's a way in which these sensations, these sounds, smells, seeing, all of that helps us steady ourselves in the present moment. It's the same way with thought. So what the Buddha's pointing to is there is a way where our thoughts can actually help us liberate this mind. And it's noticing whether our thoughts, these right thoughts, are attuned with the practice. And this attunement towards practice, he said, shows up in three ways: non-harm, kindness, and some kind of restraint. If we could live with this kind of non-harming way, this capacity for kindness that we have, and this capacity to live with some degree of restraint from our control and wanting. So I'm going to talk about those three things. Actually, the next time I come, which will be not next week, but the week after. What I want to talk about tonight is more about why this right intention is so important to help us find our way. So, in this sutta where the Buddha talks to this deva about not pushing forward, not standing still. How many of you, just a little show of hands, how many of you think you know what that means? Not pushing forward, not standing still. Anybody? I see a couple of little hands. I think you, yeah, you probably do. What you're thinking is exactly it. That sense of somehow or another pushing can overshoot the mark. And not doing nothing can kind of weaken the mark. So somehow we want to move without sort of pushing and without not doing anything. So how many of you have ever used or saw one of those push lawnmowers? Where you have to actually push it. And when I was younger, we had the push lawnmower and you had to push it to cut the grass. And of course, at the beginning of the season, right in the beginning of the spring, when you start cutting the grass, it was horrible. It takes a lot to push that. And nobody wanted to cut the grass. And so there was always this fight over whose turn it was and who's supposed to cut the grass. I never wanted to do that job. And then after a few years, my dad bought a gas lawnmower where you had a choke and you would pull the choke and then it would start going. And you could take it like a finger and push the lawnmower. It would go on its own. So this kind of like pulling the choke and creating this motor. Now you're walking with the lawnmower and it's cutting the grass and you're actually moving along cutting the grass, but it's very little effort. It's an easy process. Now everybody's fighting for the opportunity to be the one to cut the grass because there was something uniquely special about that. Well, this is what I think is the difference between this pushing, is this entanglement, trying to push our way through life versus not doing anything and the grass just grows wild. And this motor where really you pull the choke and you get that motor started and then it moves. It moves. So right intention is this pulling the choke. It's setting this intention in mind. And then this persistent coming back to that intention over and over and over, day after day after day. It's not making yourself always do the intention. Let's say we'll just start with one of them, this intention to be kind. We're going to talk about the three of them next time, but one of them is this intention for kindness. So when I first set that intention, kindness would not be the word I would associate with me. I mean, I wouldn't say I was cruel, but I was very arrogant. And so I had a sense, I was very smart, and I always got all these accolades. When I was in high school, I was senior class president. So I always had this kind of bigness about me. So I just kind of expected everybody would like me, that kind of thing. It was more like I expected people to do whatever I wanted and expected everything to go my way. And if things did not go my way, then I could get very pushy, shovey, leaning on to maybe even the cruel side when I was younger. So when I set this vow to be kind, in a dharmic way, understand kindness from Buddha's way, that is not who I was. All right? Can we be clear? That's not who I was. And most of us, when we set our vows of what we want to be, we are not that. We are something other than that. But in this right intention, you begin to question everything you do. So I begin to question, was that the kindest thing I could do? Was that kind? I don't know. I think I could have been a little kinder. I mean, there was this way in which I went through life noticing whether I was being kind. And granted, most of the time in those early days, I was not kind. It was more of me saying to myself, you could have been kinder there, Tori. That seemed harsh and mean. You might want to apologize for that. And I did do a lot of apologizing for the way I spoke. I could be very sharp and very sarcastic and rude to people if I didn't think they were doing what I wanted. So there was this way in which I could actually be meaner than I wanted to be. But here I am constantly noticing how much I am not kind. So if I were to show you this, this would be who I was. I thought I was kind, but really I'm leaning over here on the not kind side. This would be overly kind. This is where I was most of the time. And I kept noticing that I was off in the kindness, and gradually I would overshoot it sometimes and just be soupy sweet. Not very often, it's trying to put it back. Gradually, I began to feel kindness and understand kindness, not because I was always kind, but I could feel more and more sensitively what kindness was, when it was missing, when it was not there, when it was there, when I was not kind, when I was kind. And more and more and more, the kindness just began to be a normal way of me being. It's much more easier for me to just be kind now than I used to be. And even in my own family, they can see it. Not like I don't still yell at them, but there's a kindness to that yelling. You know, it's sweeter, softer, not quite so bad. Not necessarily putting them down as much as I am much more forceful about taking this serious. So I have a niece who some of you know is dying, and she's very young. She's like 35. And it's been an awkward month because she just passed out and nobody really knows what happened. And so there's this all this kind of anger and panic and frightening and trying to fix this thing. And every once in a while, people will lose themselves in their own reactivity when we get together as a family. And the part of me that knows how to yell at everybody and say, settle that down, is very important. It's very kind, because otherwise we can get caught in a very sticky, hateful, hurtful way. And what used to be yelling at people to get my way is actually a way of helping people come into the present moment with the truth of where we're at. And we don't have to hurt each other just because this whole thing is freaking everybody out. But it comes from this ability to stay with the difficulty of it and still be kind. That quality is what I was missing in the early days. I could either be over on the soupy side, or I could be on the kind of sarcastic side, but I didn't know how to stay with difficulty and still be kind, whatever it was. And my practice has taught me how to do that. It didn't teach me how to do that because I just had this envision of being this person. It taught me how to be this way because I routinely, persistently, constantly compared and checked everything I did against this beacon, compass, this light of whether or not it was kind. And even when I wasn't kind, I self-corrected. And when I was kind or too kind, self-corrected. This is what the Buddha's right intention is about. It's this attunement, not with the idea of how you should look or be, but everyone in this room has a sense of what is kindness. You have a sense of what you think kindness is, not what I think kindness is, but you think it. And you know when you're not being kind. You know when you're a little edgy here. You know when you're grumbling with your partner. You can tell when they're trying to be kind, so you can stop being grumbling, and you're grumbling anyway. You can tell, you know. And so this is more about not requiring the rest of the world to be on eggshells and make you happy so that you will be kind. And instead, you having this inner felt sense experience, this moving through the floods without pushing the world to be a certain way, without doing standing still, but you are moving through the world in this attuning way towards kindness. Attuning, 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 gradually sensing into where you believe this kindness is. You're doing it right in the present moment with whatever experience you're having. But then you look back on your life and you see you are far kinder than you were before. How that happened, I can't tell you. It's just this attuning, 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 and gradually we become kinder, 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 kinder. You could take the same thing with harm. You could notice how much harm you actually do in the world, and you could have this vow to do no harm or to do the least amount of harm in the moment. And sometimes you'll notice that you were very harmful. That is just, you got to see that and feel that. And then sometimes you'll notice that you're kind of indifferent. You're not even helpful. You're not doing any harm, but you're not helping either. And then gradually you will begin to sense into all, equally this sense of, I can see where the harm lines are. And the last is restraint. You can see how much control you have to have over everything and how painful that is. And then gradually you can see when you just don't even participate in the world, you just let things go. And then same thing, this kind of persistent noticing, and gradually you begin to trust the world enough to stay engaged and not have to control it. You don't have to control everything and still be engaged. You just learn how to do it little bit by little bit, moment by moment, situation by situation, good side, bad side, doesn't really matter. You just keep watching what you're doing. And it's like you're in a canoe. You know how when canoes go through water, it's just like slicing butter. It's like that. You just sort of go through the life trusting that you can feel your way through. And so the Buddha pointed to kindness, non-harm, and restraint as the main three qualities to set your intention around. And if you set your intention around those three qualities, then gradually, as you move through, you will move through this world, move through your life without pushing forward, without standing still. So what do you think? Do you kind of know what the Buddha was saying to this Deva? Do you kind of understand a little bit better what he was saying, right? From your own sense. Not necessarily, you can just sense it in your own kind of understanding. To live this way, to set your own vow and live within the felt sense of that vow will bring you closer to wisdom than trying to live up to somebody else's projection as to what the Dhamma is or what you should be doing. So the important part of the Eightfold Path that we're going to go through for the rest of the year is not for you to learn what is the Eightfold Path, but more for you to be able to feel what kind of view are you looking at the world through, and what's the intention here? Are you living out of the intention that you've set for yourself? And then gradually, your conduct changes and you cultivate concentration. I do think it's significant that the Buddha started with wisdom and intention, and he put concentration at the end of the path, end of it, We start with concentration, try to get the concentration, and then we're going to be okay. But actually, if you start checking your view and start checking what intentions are preceding your actions, the more you will begin to get your conduct more in alignment with that right intention, that right view, and then the more concentration just naturally arises, naturally comes, and the more wisdom you get, and then it just keeps building on itself. So, I'm hoping this month, through all these different talks and maybe some practice groups around right intention, that you'll begin to see what intention you want to set. You don't have to set all three of them. Just one. Just so you can see that you really can set an intention for yourself and use that intention as a North Star to begin to see when you're on it and when you're off. So let's just sit for a moment and then we'll take some comments. Thank you so much for your kind attention. All right. We'll see if anybody has any comments or thoughts, questions.
Thanks, Cheryl. Tweri, is the difference, I'm thinking about setting an intention, is the difference between non-harm a difference and restraint? Is that non-harm is sort of an implied non-harmful action?
Yeah, that's what it would be.
Okay.
And the restraint is, it's actually not necessarily always trying to get your way or get what's pleasurable. There's each one of us, for me, it was getting my way. I just always thought I was right. So getting my way became very important. And so that's the restraint I use, not getting my way. But it could be that your restraint could be that you always have to be right. You know, not just getting your way, but you're right all the time. And you have to be willing to have some restraint around this idea that you're right. You just think you're right, but you could be wrong. That's a hard thing for us to accept. Or that even restraint on this idea that I never get it right, or I'm never good at that. You have to have some restraint on that and stop just accepting that and actually believe that your words could have value and that you could speak up and share something. So the restraint is more on, I think it's more related to your, how you believe and how you your worldview kind of way. Whereas the harm has more to do with that felt sense of, your actions.
Okay. Thank you, Tori. Mm-hmm.
I think you could think of it one other way, is that restraint would be watching what's skillful, what's not skillful, and harm could be more of, are you causing pain or unpleasant consequences? Down here in front.
Hi. Thank you again for your words. I wanted to ask, you kind of started off with talking about sitting with difficulty, the talk, and I wanted to ask about the role that sitting with difficulty plays in sort of this like right intention.
That's a good question. Mm-hmm. So what I think is that in order for us to really begin to understand what is right intention, then you have to be able to see both the wrong intention and the right intention, and when something is not okay, and when something is kind of, I guess it's not okay on both sides. So not okay in the difficulty, not okay in the pleasure side. I think the point that Buddha was making was, we live in a world where there is difficulty. That's what we spend our lives thinking, that we're going to get to a world where there won't be any difficulty, that I'm going to figure it out and I'm going to fix it. So part of this right intention is learning to find your value in the midst of difficulty. So if you could find non-harm in the midst of a situation at work where someone is clearly doing harm, and what would that look like? So would it look like, oh, I'm not going to do nothing. They can just do the harm and everything's okay. That would be doing nothing and sinking. But you could also get all entangled in it, like, oh man, this is wrong. This person's got to go. We're going to have to do something about this. And you could get all entangled in it and not necessarily change anything either. But somehow you could find your way into a felt sense of non-harm and speak up or speak out or do something that is in keeping with this vow, and yet you are not getting entangled and you're not doing nothing. But what that would look like is going to take you being willing through trial and error to get entangled and to not do anything. And once you begin to feel that, you'll begin to learn where the line is. And that you'll know for yourself. You see? So, and part of the difficulty is that in truth, we are always going to be working through difficulty, because there's not a time in our lives when it won't be difficult. It's learning to believe that. And it's sort of like the Four Noble Truths. The Buddha said there is suffering. He didn't say there's only suffering until such and such a time. He says, no, there is suffering. And there's this constant knowing it's suffering, but there is a way to release that suffering. And that comes from the practice. And that's what we're really basically practicing into. You see? I think one last piece. The more we learn to get comfortable with suffering, with difficulty, whether it's difficulty because I want all the time or difficulty because I don't want, when we get used to difficulty and we stop treating difficulty or suffering like something's wrong, then you can feel your way through to be who you are, because you're not constantly feeling like you gotta react to this situation. Instead, you just learn to be who you are, whether it's difficult or not. And that comes from learning how to overshoot the mark and get all entangled in the mess and say, yeah, I don't want to do that. And then not doing nothing and, you know, feeling guilty because I didn't do nothing. I should have did something. That's okay too, because gradually you're going to learn. And then I could speak to my family with the same degree of fierceness that I would have when I used to yell at them. And yet I did not feel unkind at all. You see, because I know who I am and I know how I'm being, even if there's a fiercity about it. Okay, one second, and then we'll come back to you. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Mm-hmm. So you describe this process as something that's more like trial and error. So I'm wondering, what's the role of the insight meditation, like when you practice meditation? Is that a place where you can also play those scenarios and try to find this, or should it stay a pure, like, in-the-moment concentration and try to avoid polluting the meditation with those sorts of... trying to imagine what would be the right action.
So you could think of it as that's what we are doing when we're meditating. So the reason why insight meditation needs a degree of what we call concentration. It needs a degree of a willingness to focus your attention and stay here. But just a little bit. You don't need a lot. But you need to be able to, it's sort of like if I need to be able to pick up the striker if I'm going to hit the bell. So I need to have enough focus to pick up that striker. And then insight meditation itself is learning to watch the mind, learning to watch phenomena rise and pass, and begin to see that it's constantly changing, it's constantly moving, and having that wide view, what begins to happen is you're just sitting there, some thought will come in your mind, and you can begin to see yourself get all worked up over that thought. Nothing has happened, you're just sitting there. I'm looking at you, I assure you, nothing is happening. And yet, you'll be all caught up and entangled in that thought. So the insight meditation practice is really just a practice where we sit still and learn to watch what's happening. Learn to watch and see this unfolding of habit. And when you do that, you begin to learn that things come and they go. So that thought, if you don't get entangled with it, if you have a degree of restraint and you have a degree of kindness in the moment, softening in the moment, not going to do any harm, you can begin to gradually see, if I get caught up in that thought, I'm going to get all mad, I'm going to be all tight, and there's going to be harm to me, if nobody else. If I soften, and I'm kind, I have this ability to restrain and not get caught up in that thought. I don't have to. I mean, the thought's there, it comes. And if I don't get caught in it, it will pass. It will pass. And somehow that little 10, 15 minute sit, 20 minute sit, you watch this happening, doesn't matter whether your mind is all over the place, whether it's still and easy, all of it is good examples to practice with. And then gradually you begin to notice that some situation will come up and you don't argue with it. Where did that come from? You just all of a sudden stop being as reactive. And that stop being as reactive, it doesn't come from you. It comes from the mind learning what restraint is, the mind learning what kindness is, the mind learning what non-harm is, just by you sitting there and watching what's happening. You see? So that's why this practice, there is concentration practice, which is the whole goal is to unify the mind. So you just keep coming back to this persistent spot in the mind over and over and over and over and over, and you can cultivate concentration. But even if you cultivate concentration and the mind begins to get absorbed into concentration, there comes a point when the mind no longer needs you to keep putting the effort in, and it will watch itself. And still, you will see the same thing, harm, non-harm, whether you're kind, whether you're not kind, and whether there's restraint there. And if you use Vipassana to watch what's happening, and you don't sort of judge whether or not your mind is still enough or not still enough, you will ultimately get concentrated. So the two of them will work together regardless. But some people start with concentration and ultimately get to insight, and some people start with insight and ultimately get to concentration. See? Good. Down here. Okay. Go ahead.
Could you replace the word restraint with discipline, or how would you characterize that word?
I think the word that the Buddha used was renunciation. I call it restraint, but he called it renunciation. Well, I mean, that's our English translation of the word renunciation, as in you renounce or give up something. So discipline is more of, I think if that word, discipline, that feels like an active doing, right? Whereas renunciation is this resisting the urge to follow that impulse. So each of us have an impulsive way of being, and we are resisting the following of that impulse. I could see where that would be having the discipline to not follow that impulse, not follow that impulse. So I think it could be the same thing. So we'll take this one online and then in the back, and then that'll be it. Emery, how you doing?
Hi, good. Thank you. I don't know if this is a question or more of a comment, but I love the way you opened the talk with talking about how we all have this feeling of responsibility for everything that we see in the world as wrong, and that responsibility to attend to it or fix it. Or like when you said that, I was like, oh my gosh, you just described like my entire paradigm. And I don't know. It just feels like I can't hear enough times that like life is difficult. It's the way it's supposed to be. It's okay. There's not a problem. You can relax with it. You mm-hmm. can just let it be. You don't have to solve anything. It's not up to you. Like, I feel like I could hear that every day for the rest of my life and still need to practice it.
That's right. So, that's why I was reading Kamada's Lament, because that's what we sound like when we are, if we think that we are responsible for all the problems in the world. Because it's hard to fix all this. It doesn't work. Nothing anybody says is going to work. I've tried that. It's still bad. It's just this constant felt sense of the weightiness of how difficult it is, because we can't fix everything. So the other way that the Buddha's pointing to, though, is not this need of having to fix something. He's pointing to this realization that whatever conditions come together, they will fall apart on their own. You don't have to fix it. It will fall apart. And that's the thing we never get to see, because as soon as some difficult conditions come together, then we try to fix that so we can make it go away. And as soon as some good conditions come together, we try to hold on to it, and then we're going to find ourselves in difficulty when it falls away. And so what he's pointing to is, if you set the intention to live with that coming together and falling apart and coming together and falling apart, with this intention to be kind, to be non-harming, and to have some degree of restraint on your behavior, this renunciate life, then when there's a coming together and falling apart and a coming together and falling apart, you will not take on the responsibility to fix it. Like, I do not, that is exactly what was happening in our family meetings about my niece. Everyone was arguing with this passion because everyone wanted to fix this. This sort of caught us all off guard, and how do we fix it? And we're arguing about what is the way to fix it. And we get very mean in our arguing about the way to be very nice and kind to my niece. But there's all the arguing and very mean about it. And the only thing I did, you could say, was this constant mantra to get them not to be harmful to each other in this moment. Just to be kind, just to remember, it's upsetting to everybody. Be still here in this moment. And gradually we all settled down. But it's not, I did not get in the fray of trying to fix the situation. This is, it's not that I was not doing anything. It's that there was enough cooks in the kitchen that I just want everybody to stop throwing the food at each other and just like, let's chop the vegetables instead of throwing it at each other. That kind of thing. So that this what the Buddha was pointing to, I think, is to learn to stop seeing the world through problems that need to be fixed and see the world through that difficulty that's here. Can I move through this difficulty with as much kindness, non-harm, and this kind of renunciate way of allowing as best I can? Do you see the difference? So instead of, it's not so difficult that you see the world as having all these problems, but can you see, can you learn to sort of support yourself that says, like this vow you could make is, I'm going to resist the need to fix it. Might be a problem. I'm going to resist the need to fix it and live with this restraint of not fixing the problem. If you lived with that restraint and you actually had the restraint, in the beginning, you're going to tumble into fixing it, getting all entangled with it. And then sometimes you're going to be like, just turn away. Like, I don't see it. Don't see it. Don't see it. That kind of sinking, right? But gradually, you're going to begin to see that if you steady yourself with this kindness and this care, that you will see that many of the problems you think have to be fixed will straighten themselves out. They straighten themselves out. They do move into, they do come together and fall apart without you having any part in it at all. You see?
Yeah. Good. Appreciate it. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Okay, one more.
Thank you so much
for
your talk. Something I've been grappling with a lot recently that your words today made me think of more is the role of compassion and particularly self-compassion in all of this work. And one thing I've been noticing is my capacity to focus on kindness has increased in moments when my self-compassion is greater, and I don't think that's unusual.
Yes.
And when self-compassion is low, often kindness is also lower. And I'm less familiar with the role of self-compassion and how self-compassion can be part of the renunciation work. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. How can renunciation and self-compassion and compassion for others work together and support each other? Thank you.
You're actually saying it. So what you're saying is, so this is all attunement, right? So you feel this sense of this lack of self-compassion, you can feel your kindness is lessening. And that means you can also feel you're a little testy. You get a little bit on the harmful side, right? So even if you want to help, when you feel that your compassion for yourself is getting low, you will restrain. You will hold back that impulse to just jump right in there because it doesn't really work. It doesn't work for you and it doesn't work for them. So you're kind of feeling into that already. And that sense of restraint is giving yourself permission to say no and say, I can't do this. I need to take a moment here. And for many people who have this natural gift of compassion, self-restraint is the willingness to say no and be able to say no, not out of just, you know, like, I don't care, I'm on the, you know, do nothing, drowning side. And you don't have to just always say yes and get all tangled either. You can say no from this place of kindness for yourself. And you can feel it, and you can know when you've gone too far, and when you can put a little more in, and when you've gone too far. So the restraint is in the saying no when it gets too much. Can you see that? But it seems like you already see that, because you can see I'm like tumbling, I'm losing my kindness. And so there's a bit of, I need to have a little bit of restraint here so I can get it back. Yeah. That's it. Well, I will miss you next week, and then I'll be back the week after. I'll see you then, and we'll continue our practice into right intention. Thank you so much for being here.